Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer who served in Afghanistan. She's also a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly, Afghanistan was barely mentioned in the presidential campaign, as, for example, was global warming. But it's not going away. And, of course, the current recent scandal with the general in charge indicates, I mean, the fact that he's the 11th commander in 11 years in itself is a bit of a scandal, I think. So what's the prognosis going forward here, do you think?
Well, I think it at multiple levels, Afghanistan is a hot soup sandwich. I think as you have covered over the years, the strategy, of course, is that the Afghan National Security Forces are going to be in a position that they can take over primary security duties, while the Americans and our NATO partners really draw down our combat activities, and we revert to a much smaller footprint with troops over there primarily to train the ANSF. You know, the ANSF, they've come a long way, but many people are skeptical that they're going to be able to manage Afghanistan's security needs without more American and NATO assistance than either America or NATO actually wants to give. And then, of course, from the point of view of the people that are going to continue in the training capacity, as you know, the so-called green-on-blue violence is really unacceptable. And so you'll hear reports of tremendous distrust between the Afghan and U.S. NATO ISAF counterparts. So on that front, I think there's a lot of disquiet. The failure of any meaningful political dialogue with the Taliban, which is now going into its nth year of failure, has raised a lot of fears in Afghanistan itself that it's going to revert back to civil war. And then, of course, thirdly, not only was there no discussion of Afghanistan in the debate, there really wasn't a meaningful discussion of Pakistan. In the absence of a robust Pakistan strategy, many people suspect that Pakistan is going to continue doing what it's always done, which is supporting Islamist proxies, and that in itself is going to increase the likelihood that Afghanistan reverts back to some kind of a civil war-like scenario. So Afghanistan does not look good, no matter from which particular angle you examine it.
Well, already there are reports from Herat that the local warlord is preparing his army for a civil war. And of course, this has been an embarrassment to Karzai, who obviously believes that there is a national army, but most people are pretty skeptical about the real nature of the Afghan national army and whether indeed it is a national army.
No, I mean, that's true. I mean, for many years, the police, for example, would garner a lot of attention and criticism for the vast corruption, both within the police force, but then all the way up through the Ministry of Interior. For many years, people would laud the Afghan National Army as some sort of incredible institution that was somehow heads and shoulders above the others. But what we've seen in recent years is that there's quite a bit of corruption in the Ministry of Defense, that warlordism really hasn't gone away. And in fact, if you were an Afghan warlord, what incentive would you have to actually participate as a national army as opposed to a coalition of warlord militias? So, I think that's really true. And of course, one of the big problems throughout the last 11 years of fighting this war in Afghanistan is that rather than trying to find some common ground with Iran, the United States has really chosen increasingly a path of standoff with Iran. And that meant that we were increasingly dependent upon Pakistan, which would have been fine if our interests were aligned with Pakistan's interests, and obviously they weren't. So, we've put ourselves in this situation where we don't really have any regional allies, and we're really dependent upon that one country, Pakistan, whose interests are completely the opposite of ours. What Pakistan wants in Afghanistan is not what we want. And even though our current situation with Iran is certainly not appealing in any way, shape, or form, we still have more in common with the Iranians in terms of what kind of Afghanistan we'd like to see than we have with the Pakistanis. And so it's disappointing looking at the way in which the Americans have handled not only the domestic situation in Afghanistan, but also the regional picture as well and the relationships with Afghans near and not so near neighbors.
Again, I'm speaking with Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer who served in Afghanistan. She is a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. So given the recent downfall of General Petraeus, what's your sense of his contribution, if you will, to this situation? It seems in retrospect that the so-called surge in Afghanistan didn't achieve anything, as far as I can tell, and it just prolonged the agony between these two competing strategic visions of counterinsurgency versus counterterrorism. So what's your assessment?
I mean, so I've been in the boat that says the surge was a bad idea for years. You know, I can say that I did congressional testimony in 2009 as the Obama administration was being corralled into sending the surge and saying very clearly that it's a bad idea. It was a bad idea for a couple of reasons. One, the proponents of the surge, based upon Petraeus's infamous FM-324, Field Manual 324, which was accorded some stature in so-called pacifying Iraq. Now, historians will eventually adjudicate whether or not this switch to a so-called coin posture in Afghanistan was more important than other factors in Iraq. But what you definitely saw was that this whole industry of coinistas, and we're talking about Andrew Exum, John Nagel, David Kilcullen, obviously McChrystal, Petraeus, you know, this whole coinista industry did feel that this was a way forward in Afghanistan. Those of us who know the region were very skeptical for a number of reasons. If you actually look at the country studies upon which FM-324 was based, they were all largely post-colonial. They had functioning bureaucracies. The insurgency tended to be urban. In other words, all of the characteristics were really not applicable to Afghanistan. And of course, even if you took those numbers, if you took FM-324 at face value and you actually took the math to have any sort of biblical, Quranic, or Talmudic truth, you really needed something on the order of 375 to 400,000 troops. So the surge made no sense in terms of its justification vis-a-vis FM-324. There were not any battlefield effects. You know, for example, when you're going to talk about a surge, you would have expected the commanders to have said, we're going to achieve these battlefield effects. To achieve these battlefield effects, we need to accomplish XYZ. To accomplish XYZ, we need to have these kinds of troops increased in these kinds of numbers and with these kinds of assets in place. None of that calculation took place. They pulled this number, 30,000, initially 40,000, out of their posteriors. And, you know, I think I have to agree with you. It's not clear what the surge has secured. You remember Operation Mosh-Dagh in Helmand, where the U.S. media was seized. Very quickly, that operation fell out of the attention of the media because it didn't go as planned. And so I think, you know, what we've seen at the end of the surge is we've lost many more Americans. Many more Afghans have died. Obviously, our partners in NATO ISAF have also perished. And I think it's unfortunate that the reason why General Petraeus is being raked over the coals is because of who he screwed and not who he screwed over, which, quite frankly, are the Americans and the troops that we sent into harm's way. I think it's very unfortunate that the only scrutiny that he is being subjected to is over his personal life and, quite frankly, not the management of this war and a set of policy prescriptions that actually has been very injurious to our forces in Afghanistan.
So again, Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer who served in Afghanistan. She's now a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. I remember speaking with David Kilcullen, of course, he was very much General Petraeus' eyes and ears in Iraq, and then served with him in Afghanistan and came up with this concept of the armed social worker. And I've never understood what we thought we were doing there in terms of nation building, which we've apparently been completely unsuccessful at, even though billions of dollars have been spent. There's precious little to show for it. So how can you do nation building in a nation that's never been able to sustain itself, at least in the modern era?
Well, you know, again, you know, as you know, I mean, we've discussed this several times over the years on this show. When the British were institution building in the Indian subcontinent, they actually did that over a series of several hundred years. So, for example, the parts of India that became North India, for example, the Delhi area and so forth, that part of India had been subjected to, you know, well over 250 years of colonial intervention. And of course, you know, the whole process that you know, I'm not defending colonialism. I'll be very, very clear. But the process by which that took place was, first you had this encounter with militarism. Then you had this essentially imported bureaucracy with Brits running the show. And then they went through this process of indigenization. And by the time 1947, 48 came around, the parts that became India had largely been indigenized. And compare that to the parts that became Pakistan, they were still very much in the militarized phase of that. In fact, the Punjab had become part of the Raj only circa 1860. So it was a relatively late comer to the game. So when you ask what can be accomplished in 11 years, I mean, you put that in the context of it took the British 250 some odd years to create institutions. And those are still the institutions that India functions with today, the constitution, the courts, the relationship between the states and the central government, the provincial governments. What people thought could be accomplished in 11 years, I think, is risible. I think people made a lot of comparisons to the Balkans. You remember the RAND Corporation made a lot of hay, how we haven't put enough money into Afghanistan. I was skeptical of that argument as well. The reason being is that in the Balkans, when we did our nation-building exercise, there was actually already a substantial amount of institutionalization and human capital. There was simply not a comparable infrastructure into which those investments were made in Afghanistan. And I think, you know, over the course of time, as we can sort of sift through what happened and with what consequences, I think the argument can be made that the ways in which investments were made in Afghanistan pretty much sealed the fate of demise for Afghan institutions, in the sense that more than anything, it fostered corruption. You know, you simply can't, you know, force those kinds of funds through the particular structures that were in place in Afghanistan. So, you know, I would like to see, as I said, more accountability held to the masterminds of our Afghan strategy and why they failed, why they were so certain, the promises that they made that they failed to keep. I'd like to see the criticism really be shown in those areas rather than the, you know, the various sexual peccadillos of the men in uniform. I think that's really a sideshow. It might be symptomatic of what was going on, that these generals had become celebrities, that these generals saw that they were too important to follow the rules to which they subjected their subordinates. But ultimately, that's symptomatic. It's not causal. How is it that we had these runaway generals that were so confident that their policies would work, and yet they clearly haven't, and yet the only thing to which they're being held accountable is their sex lives? I just don't understand that.
Well, Christine Farah, I understand that, having read Rajiv Chandrasekharan's book about Afghanistan, that there's also quite a bit of blame to lay at the civilian aid people like USAID. One of the stories in his book that's extraordinary is that we've heard so much about the heroin trade and trying to eradicate it, and which that's the source of so much corruption and this kind of narco-kleptocracy that Karzai family represents, that they, you know, they could have substituted that crop, but I take it it was the cotton lobby in the United States that stopped it. I'm not sure of why.
No, I mean, that's a little bit more complicated. I mean, so essentially, there's about four-ish countries that legally produce poppy. Australia is one of them, Turkey, India, I think there's a fourth. Essentially, for Afghanistan to be allowed to grow poppy as one of these licensed legal poppy growers, this has to go through the UN. And at every point along the way, India, Turkey, and Australia rejected allowing Afghanistan to do that. And the reason being is that obviously when you flood the market, you affect the price. And so those countries that are in this cartel of legally producing poppy enjoy the situation that they have. And so everyone talks about, you know, Afghanistan to be allowed to legally export its poppy. Given the way in which that particular regime is managed, it sounds a lot easier than it actually is. The other problem, and I think the Americans learned this pretty quickly early on, is that you really can't fight the narcotics problem and an insurgency at the same time. The reason being that if you look at where the poppy is growing, it's where there's no control of the state. Where there's no control of the state, it's also where the Taliban are. So, some of the most insurgency-afflicted provinces in Afghanistan is also where the poppy is most prevalent. And that's probably because both poppy and the Taliban flourish where the state does not. Now, if you're trying to cultivate local support to provide intelligence against the Taliban and the various warlords that are affiliated with them, what you probably don't want to do is knock out the single most important source of income for your informants, and that's poppy. So pretty early on, the Americans concluded that we're not going to do counter-narcotics while we're also trying to do counterinsurgency. The problem is, as you noted, that unfortunately, the Taliban, you know, in the 90s, they were largely dependent upon Pakistan for sole source funding. And so the Pakistanis could cut that funding off as they saw fit. Now the Taliban are pretty much self-financing in various degrees through international donations, through the poppy trade, through a variety of other illegal and illicit trafficking of, you know, gems, marble, wood, you know, forest timber. So they're much more self-sustained financially than they were during the 90s under the Pakistanis. So, you know, while admitting that you can't fight both of those battles at the same time, your inability to do that pretty much conceded the Taliban as much financial space to cultivate poppy as they could, and that's what they did.
Well, I was actually referring to this plan to substitute their crop and grow cotton or something else. And my understanding was that fell apart because of the lobby here against cotton imports.
Yeah, well, I can't speak to that, but no. Of course, these are not nearly as profitable products.
Sure.
And cotton and poppy, they are not completely substitutable. I mean, poppy really is, you know, there are certain conditions under which poppy grows, and there's certain conditions under which cotton grows, and there's some overlap. But the overlap is not perfect, and the profit margins. I mean, one of the advantages of poppy, if we can speak of it in those terms, is that there are multiple processes along the way, and the value added of each of those processes is much more than your value added for cotton, right? Mm-hmm. And poppy is a very manpower, person power intensive activity. So I don't think cotton was ever going to be the panacea for this. There's been some discussion of saffron substitution, for example. But again, you know, for you to be able to do crop substitution does suggest that you've got some control over that territory. And where the Taliban have been most effective, we don't have control over that territory, right?
Sure.
And the other thing that people sometimes forget is that the Taliban are kind of, they're the local lenders as well. And farmers are sequentially in debt to the Taliban, right? The Taliban lend them money to buy the seed for the poppy, for the various things they need to get the poppy to grow, you know, fertilizers and so forth. The Taliban help go, you know, basically go to the farm gate to buy the product. And so essentially you have to imagine this huge amount of forward debt that the farmers carry that they're indebted to the Taliban. So simply substituting crops doesn't get the farmers out of this cycle of indebtedness that they have to the Taliban. And I think that's something people just don't understand.
Just in closing, Christine Fair, let's turn to Pakistan, since it's the Gordian knot here. And since the assassination attempt by the Pakistani Taliban on the young schoolgirl, Malala, who's gained international attention, there's been some evidence inside Pakistan itself, perhaps of some kind of soul-searching.
I think it's nonsense. It's risible.
Right.
I mean, we've seen this. We've seen this before. We can point to 5 or 6 events over the last 11 years, and people say this is going to be the turning point when Pakistan decides whether it's going to be a jihadi state or not. But very quickly, conspiracy theories began spreading in Pakistan that shifted the criticism away from the Taliban onto other agencies. So, for example, and there are several variations of this, but there is a growing suspicion that Malala was not, in fact, shot by the Taliban. And their argument goes, if the Taliban had shot her at point-blank range in the face, she should have been dead. Therefore, since she's not dead, she must have been shot by a CIA agent, an Indian intelligence agent, RAW. There's even some bizarre conspiracy about drones being involved. And these are meant to defame, this attack was meant to defame the Islamists, because after all, if the Islamists had wanted to kill her, she would be dead. It's a little bit like the witch burning, right? You throw the witch into the water, if she drowns, she's a witch. If she survives, burn her because she's a witch. I mean, it's just really the equivalent of that. And so, I've been around Pakistan far too long to be remotely optimistic that any of these things will have the sea shift that we would expect it to have, because of, the vast willingness of Pakistanis to believe bizarre conspiracies. And, that's the susceptibility of Pakistanis to peculiar conspiracies is, that's a whole different topic. Sometimes people look at me with some incredulity, and I point out, well, this is, a country that 2 months ago thought that they had invented a car that runs on water. So, what people need to understand is that the Pakistan Intelligence Agency has a lot of sway over Pakistani media, and they can give or detract attention to particular events selectively to suit their agenda. And so I'm not optimistic. I mean, as I said, the Pakistanis somehow think that the Blackwater, for example, is a potential culprit for having shot Malala because she is not dead. I mean, what do you do with that? I mean, that speaks to a sort of public pathology that's very difficult to understand. But rest assured, this is not going to be the turning point for Pakistan. But having said that, I don't know what will be the turning point for Pakistan. I mean, they've had prime ministers assassinated. They've had a little girl shot. They've had corps commanders nearly assassinated. They've had a sustained campaign against the state since 2004 on the part of proxies gone wild. I mean, you'd think that at some point someone would have concluded that running Islamist militant proxies is not the best way to run a country, but they certainly haven't come to that conclusion yet.
So do you think, though, that after the 2014 pullout of the U.S., and that's not to suggest that there are not going to be troops left behind or special forces left behind in Afghanistan, but if the U.S. were to reduce its footprint sufficiently in Pakistan that the Pakistanis wouldn't have the excuse to blame everything on the Americans, would that make any difference?
No, because they're still going to find some way. I mean, one of Pakistan's unfortunate strategies is to externalize the reasons for its varied problems and blame it upon Americans, the Israelis, the Indians, the Afghans, what have you. This is a complicated game that the Army plays to deflect any sort of criticism or blame. And, already, I mean, some of the Pakistani narratives are, we're in this situation with our Pakistan Taliban because of the American war. And when the Americans leave, the Pak Talibs will go back to fighting the Indians or fighting the Afghans, and they'll stop targeting us. So for many Pakistanis, the solution to their Pakistan problem is for NATO and ISAF to go away so that the Taliban can go back to Afghanistan. And they, this is not going to work out as they imagine, because the Pakistan Taliban are not the Afghan Taliban. They do not want the same things. They want different things. So, Pakistan is going to be in for a series of rude awakenings. But I don't, it's just hard to imagine what's going to make the Pakistani state get over its jihad habit. I'm just not, it's just difficult to see anything that's going to be so shocking and to put such a shock to the Pakistani system that they reverse what's really been a strategy since 1947. And it has been their strategy since 1947. It's not new. So I'm not optimistic. And I'm also looking at the political process in Pakistan right now. They're also going to be gearing up for an election some point next year. And you just look what their electoral possibilities are. They're Imran Khan. He's a Taliban apologist. AQ Khan, the black market nuclear marketeer, is launching his own political party. And then, of course, you have the mainstay political parties, which have been feckless and corrupt. So, it's difficult to look around and see a Thomas Jefferson on the Pakistani horizon.
Well, on that note, I thank you so much for joining us, Christine Fair.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Christine Fair, former United Nations political officer who served in Afghanistan. She's a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and find answers to questions that a lot of listeners have been sending in lately. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.